beseeching the jury and the court, if the identity of Jean Valjean seemed evident to them, to apply police penalties to him that addressed the issue of breaking parole and not the appalling punishment that smites the repeat offender. The counsel for the prosecution responded to the defense counsel. He was bad-tempered and floridly red-faced, like most prosecutors. He congratulated the defense counsel on his loyalty and cleverly took advantage of this loyalty. He attacked the accused using all the points the defense had conceded. The defense seemed to agree that the accused was Jean Valjean. He noted this. The man was therefore Jean Valjean. This fact was now an established fact for the prosecution and could no longer be contested. Here, through a cunning bit of autonomasia, going back to the sources and the causes of criminal behavior, the counsel for the prosecution thundered against the immorality of the Romantic school, then dawning under the name Satanic school, which had been bestowed upon it by the critics of the Oriflamme and the Quotidien. Not without credibility, he attributed to the influence of this perverse literature the crime of Champmathieu, or rather, Jean Valjean. These considerations exhausted, he moved on to Jean Valjean himself. What was Jean Valjean? Description of Jean Valjean, a monster spewed out, etc. The model for these sorts of descriptions is provided by the tale of Théramène, which is not much use for tragedy, but serves legal eloquence brilliantly every day. Audience and jury quaked. The description over with, the counsel for the prosecution launched into an oratorical movement intended to excite the greatest possible enthusiasm on the part of the Journal de la Préfecture the following morning. "And it is a man like this, etc., etc., a vagrant, a beggar, with no means of support, etc., etc., accustomed by his past life to culpable actions and barely checked by his time in jail, as the crime committed against Petit Gervais proves, etc., etc., it is a man like this who, caught on the public highway in the very act of theft, a few feet from a wall he'd scaled, still holding in his hand the object he'd stolen, denies being caught in the act, denies the theft, the scaling of the wall, denies everything, denies even his name, denies even his identity. Apart from 100 other proofs we need not go back over, 4 witnesses recognize him. Javert, upstanding inspector of police. Javert, as well as 3 of his old companions in ignominy, the convicts Brevet, Chenildieu, and Cochepaille. What does he offer against this devastating unanimity? Denial. Talk about hard. You will take the law into your hands, gentlemen of the jury, etc., etc. While the counsel for the prosecution spoke, the accused listened, his mouth hanging open, in a sort of amazement that was colored with a little admiration. He was obviously surprised that a man could talk like that. From time to time, at the most energetic moments of the prosecutor's speech, in those instants when eloquence cannot contain itself and spills over in a flow of withering epithets, enveloping the accused like a storm, he slowly shook his head from right to left and from left to right, a sad and mute sort of protest that he'd contented himself with since the beginning of the debates. 2 or 3 times, the spectators closest to him heard him say under his breath, "This is where it's got us, not asking Monsieur Baloux." The counsel for the prosecution remarked to the jury on this stunned, obviously calculated attitude, which denoted not imbecility but skill, ruse, the habit of misleading the law, and that showed the profound perversity of the man in its true light. He ended by expressing reservations about the Petit Gervais affair and by calling for a severe sentence. That was, as you will recall, hard labor in perpetuity. The defense counsel rose, began by complimenting Monsieur the counsel for the prosecution on his admirable speech, then responded as best he could, but he tailed off feebly. The ground was evidently giving way beneath him. The strategy of denial. The moment for closing the proceedings had come. The presiding judge asked the accused to stand and put the usual question to him. "Have you anything to add to your defense?" The man stood twirling a grubby cap in his hands and didn't seem to have heard. The judge repeated the question. This time the man heard. He seemed to understand. He gave a start as though he'd just woken up, cast his eye all around him, looked at the public, the gendarmes, his lawyer, the jury, the court, placed his monstrous fist on the rim of the bar standing in front of his seat, gave everything the once-over again, and suddenly, fixing his gaze on the counsel for the prosecution, broke into speech. It was like an eruption. The words seemed to escape from his mouth, incoherent, impetuous, jumbled, as though they were all rushing to get out at once. He said, "I've got this to say. I used to be a wheelwright in Paris, and that was with Monsieur Ballou, too. It's a hard slog. If you're a wheelwright, you have to work outdoors all the time, in yards, under open sheds if you've got good masters, never in closed workshops, because you've got to have room. You see, in winter you get so cold you have to flap your arms to keep warm. But the masters don't like that. They reckon that wastes time. Handling iron when there's ice on the pavement, that's tough. It wears a man out pretty quick. You're old before your time in this line of work. At 40, a man's finished. Me, I was 53. I was really pushing it, and then workers are a nasty lot. When a poor bugger's no longer young, they call you an old nitwit, an old noodle. I wasn't making more than 30 sous a day. They paid me as little as they could. The masters took advantage of my age. On top of that, I had my daughter, who was a washerwoman down by the river. She made a bit to put in. That way, with the two of us, we got by. She had it hard, too. All the livelong day, in a tub up to her waist, come rain, come snow, with the wind whipping your face. Even if it's freezing, doesn't matter. You got to get the washing done. There are some who don't have a lot of linen, so they're waiting on it. If you don't get their washing done, you lose the business. The planks aren't joined right, and water drips on you from all sides. You get your skirts all wet, top and bottom. You get soaked to the bone. She also worked in the laundry at the Enfant Rouge, where the water comes through taps. You're not in a tub. You do your washing in front of you at the tap, and you do your rinsing behind you in a trough. Because it's indoors, your body doesn't get so cold. But there's the steam from the hot water, and it's something shocking, and it ruins your eyes. She'd get home at 7 at night, and she'd get to bed quick. She'd be so beat. Her husband hit her. She died. We weren't very happy. She was a good sort who never went to dances, who kept herself to herself. I remember one Shrove Tuesday, when she went to bed at 8 o'clock. That's it. I'm not kidding. You only got to ask. Oh, ask. Fat chance. What an idiot I am. Paris is a bottomless pit. Who knows Father Champmathieu there? But, like I was saying, there's Monsieur Ballou. Go and see Monsieur Ballou. I don't know what else you want me to say." The man stopped speaking, but stayed on his feet. He had said what he had to say in a voice that was loud, fast, raucous, hard, and hoarse, with a sort of irritated and savage naivete. At one point he broke off to greet someone in the crowd. The sorts of affirmations he seemed to be casting to the winds before him came to him like hiccups, and he added to each of them the gesture of a woodcutter splitting wood. When he had finished, the audience burst out laughing. He looked at the public, saw that they were laughing, and though he didn't understand, started to laugh himself. That was ominous. The presiding judge, an attentive and benevolent man, spoke out. He reminded the gentlemen of the jury that old Monsieur Ballou, the former master wheelwright the accused claimed to have worked for, had been summoned to no avail. He had gone bankrupt and was nowhere to be found. Then he turned to the accused and advised him to listen to what he was about to say, adding, "You are in a situation where you must think carefully. The most serious assumptions weigh against you and may have critical consequences. As the accused, and in your own interest, I must ask you again to explain yourself clearly one last time on two counts. First, did you, yes or no, climb over the wall of Pierron Close, break off the branch, and steal the apples, that is to say, commit the crime of theft, aggravated by illegal entry? Second, yes or no, are you the freed convict, Jean Valjean?" The accused shook his head with a competent look, like a man who has understood and knows what he's going to say in reply. He opened his mouth, turned to the judge, and said, "First off." Then he looked at his cap, he looked at the ceiling, and was silent. "Would the accused," the counsel for the prosecution went on in a stony voice, "please be very careful. You have not answered the questions put to you. Your distress condemns you. It is obvious that your name is not Champmathieu, that you are the convict, Jean Valjean, first disguised under the name Champmathieu, which was his mother's name, that you have been in the Auvergne, that you were born in Faverolles, where you were a pruner. It is obvious that you stole ripe apples from Pierron Close after illegal entry. The gentlemen of the jury will take this into account." The accused had ended up sitting back down. He shot to his feet again when the counsel for the prosecution was finished and cried out, "You're a nasty piece of work, you are. That's what I wanted to say. It wouldn't come to me at first. I didn't steal anything. I'm a man who doesn't eat every day. I was coming from out Aiyue. I was walking through the countryside after a shower that made the land all yellow. Even the ponds were overflowing, and all that was sticking up out of the sand was little grass shoots along the roadway. I found a broken branch lying on the ground with apples on it. I picked the branch up without knowing the trouble that would get me into. I've been in prison for 3 months now, and I've been knocked around. More than that, I can't say. They say things against me. They tell me, answer. The gendarme, who's a good lad, he nudges my elbow and whispers to me, 'Go on, answer.' I don't know how to explain. Me, I didn't have any schooling. I'm a poor man. That's where you go wrong, not seeing that. I didn't steal. I picked up what was lying on the ground. You talk about Jean Valjean, Champmathieu. I don't know those people. They must be village people. I worked for Monsieur Balou, Boulevard de l'Hôpital. My name's Champmathieu. You must be pretty clever to tell me where I was born. Me, I have no idea. Not everybody has a house to come into the world in. That'd be too easy. I think my father and my mother were people who worked the roads, but I don't know. When I was a kid, they called me little. Now they call me old. That's my Christian names for you. Take that however you like. I have been to the Auvergne. I have been to Faverolles, sure. So what? Can't a man go to the Auvergne or to Faverolles without having been in the clink? I tell you, I never stole, and that I am old man Champmathieu. I was with Monsieur Balou. He put me up in his house. You're really starting to get my goat with all this garbage, you know. Why is everybody after me trying to bring me down?"
The counsel for the prosecution had remained standing. He addressed the presiding judge.
"Monsieur le Président, in the presence of the confused but extremely cunning denials of the accused, who is clearly trying to pass himself off as an idiot, but who will not succeed, we warn him. We request that it please you and that it please the court to once again call to the bar the convicts Brevet, Cochepaille, and Chenildieu, and Police Inspector Javert, and to interrogate them one last time about the identity of the accused as the convict Jean Valjean."
"I must remind Monsieur the counsel for the prosecution," said the presiding judge, "that Police Inspector Javert was called by his duties to the administrative center of a neighboring district, and left the court and left the town itself the moment his testimony was given. We gave him permission to do so, with the consent of Monsieur the counsel for the prosecution and the accused's defense counsel."
"That's right, Monsieur le Président," the counsel for the prosecution chimed in. "In the absence of Inspector Javert, I believe I should remind the gentlemen of the jury what he said in this very place a few hours ago. Javert is an esteemed police officer who, through his strict and rigorous probity, does honor to his subordinate but important duties. This is his statement. 'I do not even need moral assumptions and material proofs to refute the denials of the accused. I recognize him perfectly. This man's name is not Champmathieu. He is a former convict named Jean Valjean, who is very dangerous and very much feared. It was only with the utmost regret that he was released after serving his sentence. He did 19 years hard labor for aggravated theft. He tried to escape 5 or 6 times. Apart from the Petit Gervais and Pierron robberies, I suspect him of having further committed theft at the home of His Grace, the late Bishop of Digne. I often saw him in the days
when I was assistant warden at Toulon Jail. I repeat that I recognize him perfectly." This very precise statement appeared to produce a rousing impression on the public and the jury. The counsel for the prosecution wound up by insisting that in the absence of Javert, the three witnesses, Brevet, Chenildieu, and Cochepaille, be heard again and solemnly cross-examined. The presiding judge gave an order to an usher, and a moment later the door of the witness chamber opened. The usher, accompanied by a gendarme ready to come to his aid, escorted the convict Brevet into the courtroom. The audience was breathless with suspense, and all hearts beat as one. The former convict Brevet was wearing the black and grey jacket of the state penitentiaries. Brevet was a character 60 years old or so, who had the face of a businessman and the look of a shyster. They sometimes go together. In prison, where fresh misdemeanors had led him once more, he had become some sort of gatekeeper. He was a man of whom his superiors said he is trying to make himself useful. The chaplains spoke highly of his religious habits. You must not forget this happened under the Restoration. "Brevet," said the president, "you are sentenced for a heinous crime, and you cannot take the oath." Brevet lowered his gaze. "However," the president went on, "even in the man the law has degraded, there may remain, when divine pity allows, a feeling of honor and fairness. It is to this feeling that I appeal at such a decisive moment. If such a feeling still exists in you, and I hope it does, reflect before you answer me. Consider, on the one hand, this man whom a word from you may destroy, and on the other hand, justice, which a word from you may clarify. The moment is a solemn one, and there is still time for you to retract if you think you have made a mistake. Would the accused please stand? Brevet, look carefully at the accused. Gather your recollections and tell us, on your soul and conscience, if you still recognize this man as your former prison mate, Jean Valjean." Brevet looked at the accused, then turned to the court. "Yes, Your Honor. I was the first to recognize him, and I still do. This man is Jean Valjean. Entered Toulon in 1796, and came out in 1815. I came out the year after. He looks like a real brute now. That'd be age that's done that to him. In jail he was sly. I'm positive I recognize him." "Go and sit down," said the president. "The accused will remain standing." Chenildieu was brought in, a convict for life, as his red jersey and green cap indicated. He was serving his sentence at Toulon jail and had been removed from there for this matter. He was a small man of 50 or so, lively, weathered, puny, yellow, cheeky, frantic, whose limbs and whose whole person exhibited a sort of sickly feebleness and whose eyes expressed immense strength. His prison mates had nicknamed him Génie Dieu, I deny God. The president addressed almost identical words to him as to Brevet. The minute he reminded him that his infamy deprived him of the right to take the oath, Chenildieu raised his head and looked straight at the audience. The president invited him to gather his thoughts and asked him, as he had asked Brevet, if he still recognized the accused. Chenildieu burst out laughing. "By God, recognize him! We were attached to the same chain for 6 years. Aren't you talking to me any more, old fella?" "You may sit down," said the judge. The usher wheeled in Cochepaille. This other lifer, who had come straight from jail and who was dressed in red like Chenildieu, was a peasant from Lourdes, half-man, half-Pyrenees bear. He had guarded flocks in the mountains and had gone downhill from shepherd to thief. Cochepaille was no less savage and seemed even stupider than the accused. He was one of those luckless men that nature churns out as wild animals to start with, and that society turns into galley-slaves in the end. The president tried to prod him with a few pathetic and solemn words and asked him, as with the other two, whether he still, without hesitation and without any trouble, recognized the man standing before him.
"It's Jean Valjean," said Cochepaille. "We even called him Jean the Jack. He was so strong."
Each of the affirmations of these three men, obviously sincere and made in good faith, had stirred up a murmur that boded ill for the accused, a murmur that grew and lasted longer each time a new declaration was added to the preceding one. The accused, for his part, listened to them with the stunned look that, according to the prosecution, was his principal defense. At the first, the gendarmes next to him heard him mutter between clenched teeth, "Well, I'll be buggered." After the second, he said a bit louder, with an almost gratified air, "Terrific!" At the third, he shouted, "Marvelous!" The president addressed him. "The accused has heard the testimony. What do you have to say?" He answered, "I say, marvelous!" A rumble broke out in the crowd and almost reached the jury. It was obvious the man was finished. "Ushers," said the president, "call the room to order. I am about to close the case." At that moment, a movement was made right next to the judge. A voice was heard crying out, "Brevet! Chenildieu! Cochepaille! Look over here!" All who heard this voice froze, it was so harrowing and so terrible. All eyes turned to the spot from whence it had come. A man, placed among the privileged spectators sitting behind the judge and jury, had just stood up, had pushed the door at elbow height that separated the bench from the well of the courtroom, and was now standing in the middle of the room. The judge, the counsel for the prosecution, Monsieur Bamatabois, 20 people recognized him and cried out in unison, "Monsieur Madeleine!" Champmathieu, more and more amazed. It was indeed him. The clerk's lamp lit up his face. He was holding his hat in his hand. There was nothing out of place in his attire. His redding coat was carefully buttoned up. He was pale and shaking slightly. His hair, still grey when he arrived in Arras, was not yet completely white when he first stepped into the courtroom. It had gone white in the hour he had been there. All heads looked up. The sensation was indescribable. There was a moment of hesitation in the auditorium. The voice had been so poignant, the man standing there looked so calm, that at first nobody could work out what was going on. Everybody wondered who had cried out. Nobody could believe that it was this serene-looking man who had let out that hair-raising cry. The confusion lasted only a few seconds before the presiding judge and the counsel for the prosecution could say a word, before the gendarmes and the ushers could make a move. The man everyone still called Monsieur Madeleine at the time had advanced toward the witnesses, Cochepaille, Brevet, and Chenildieu. "Don't you recognize me?" he said. All three sat stunned and signaled by a shake of the head that they did not know him. Cochepaille was intimidated and gave a military salute. Monsieur Madeleine turned toward the jurors and toward the court and said, in a soft voice, "Gentlemen of the jury, let the accused go. Monsieur le Président, arrest me. The man you are looking for is not this man. It is me. I am Jean Valjean." No one breathed. The initial commotion caused by amazement gave way to a sepulchral silence. You could feel in the room that kind of religious terror that takes hold of the crowd when something great is being enacted. But the judge's face was stamped with sympathy and sadness. He had exchanged a quick sign with the counsel for the prosecution and a few words under his breath with the counsel assessors. He addressed the public and asked in a tone that was understood by all, "Is there a doctor in the house?" The counsel for the prosecution took the floor. "Gentlemen of the jury, this very strange and unexpected incident that has disturbed this hearing inspires in us, as in you, only a feeling we have no need to express. You all know, at least by reputation, the Honorable Monsieur Madeleine, Mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer. If there is a doctor in the audience, we join Monsieur le Président in begging him to please come to Monsieur Madeleine's assistance and to take him home." Monsieur Madeleine did not let the counsel for the prosecution finish. He interrupted him in a tone full of indulgence and authority. "Here are the words he spoke. We record them verbatim, such as they were immediately written down after the hearing by one of those who witnessed this scene, such as they are still ringing in the ears of those who heard them, now nearly 40 years ago.
Thank you, Monsieur the Counsel for the Prosecution, but I am not mad.
You will see. You are on the point of committing a grave mistake. Let this man go. I am performing a duty. I am the sorry convict. I am the only one who can see clearly here, and I am telling you the truth. What I am doing at this moment, God, who is on high, looks down upon, and that is enough. You can take me, for here I am. And yet I did my best. I hid under another name. I became rich, I became mayor. I wanted to fit in with honest people. It seems that this is not to be. To be brief, there are a lot of things I can't tell you. I'm not going to tell you the story of my life. One day you'll know. I did rob Monseigneur the Bishop. It's true. I did rob Petit Gervais. It's true. They were right when they told you Jean Valjean was a mean wretch of a man. He is not, perhaps, entirely to blame. Listen, your honors, a man as humbled as I am has no business remonstrating with Providence or giving society advice. But you see, the infamy I tried to put behind me is a damaging thing. The galleys make the galley slave. Think about that, if you will. Before jail, I was a poor peasant, not too bright, a sort of dimwit. Jail changed me. I was stupid. I became mean. I was a great lump. I became a firebrand. Later, goodness and compassion saved me, just as severity had once sunk me. Sorry. Forgive me, you can't understand what I'm saying here. You will find, at my place, in the ashes in the fireplace, the 40-sous coin I stole 7 years ago from Petit Gervais. I have nothing further to say. Take me.
My God! Monsieur the Counsel for the Prosecution is shaking his head. You say Monsieur Madeleine has lost his mind. You don't believe me. I tell you, that is appalling. Do not condemn this man, at least. How's that? These men don't recognize me. I wish Javert were here. He'd recognize me. That's for sure.
Nothing could convey the somber and melancholy tone in which these words were spoken. He turned to the three convicts.
Well, I recognize you. I certainly do. Gervais. Do you remember?
He broke off, hesitated for a moment, and then said,
Do you remember those checked wool braces you used to have in jail?
Brevet gave a start of surprise and studied him from head to toe with a frightened look. He continued,
Chenildieu, you gave yourself the nickname of Genidieu. You have a terrible burn over the whole of your right shoulder, from lying down one day with your shoulder on a chafing dish full of smouldering embers to erase the three letters TFP, which can still be seen even so. Answer me, is that true?
It is true, said Chenildieu.
He addressed Cochepaille.
Cochepaille, close to the crook of your left arm you have a date carved in blue letters with burnt powder. This date is the day the Emperor landed in Caen. March 1st, 1815. Roll up your sleeve.
Cochepaille rolled up his sleeve, as all eyes around him were riveted to his bare arm. A gendarme brought a lamp closer. The date was there. The poor man turned toward the audience and toward the judges with a smile that still, to this day, breaks the hearts of those who saw it when they think of it. It was a smile of triumph, and it was also a smile of despair.
So you see, he said, I am Jean Valjean.
There were no longer in the ring either judges or accusers or gendarmes. There were only staring eyes and hearts that were deeply moved. No one any longer remembered the role that each one might be assigned to play. The counsel for the prosecution forgot he was there to prosecute. The presiding judge, that he was there to preside, the defense counsel, that he was there to defend. The striking thing is that no question was asked. No authority intervened. The peculiarity of sublime spectacles is to seize all souls and make all witnesses spectators. Perhaps none of them realized what he was experiencing. No doubt none of them told himself he was seeing a great light shining there in all its splendor. But all felt inwardly dazzled. It was obvious that they had Jean Valjean before their very eyes. That shone out clear as the light of day. This man's emergence had been enough to completely illuminate an episode so completely obscure just a moment before. Without there being any need for any further explanation now, the entire crowd, as by a sort of electric revelation, understood at once and at a single glance the simple and magnificent story of a man giving himself up so that another man was not condemned in his place. The details, the hesitations, the possible niggling reluctance, were lost in this vast, luminous fact. The impression swiftly passed, but for the moment it was irresistible. "I don't want to disturb the proceedings any further," Jean Valjean went on. "I'll be off, since no one wants to arrest me. I have several things to do. Monsieur the counsel for the prosecution knows who I am. He knows where I am going. He will have me arrested when he is ready." He headed for the exit door. Not a voice rose. Not an arm shot out to stop him. Everyone moved aside. He had something divine about him at that moment, a quality that forces the multitudes to draw back and make way before a man. He moved through the crowd slowly. No one ever knew who opened the door, but it is certain that the door was found open when he reached it. Having gotten that far, he turned round and said, "Monsieur the counsel for the prosecution, I remain at your disposal." Then he addressed the audience. "All of you, all who are here, you find me worthy of pity, don't you? My God, when I think what I was on the point of doing, I find myself worthy of envy. Yet I'd have preferred none of this happened." He went out, and the door shut as it had opened, for those who do certain supremely good and mighty things are always sure of being served by someone in the crowd. Less than an hour later, the jury's verdict unburdened the man named Champmathieu from all accusation, and Champmathieu, immediately set free, walked away, stunned, believing all men mad, and not understanding a thing about the vision he'd beheld. Book 8. Aftershock. In what mirror Monsieur Madeleine looks at his hair. Day was beginning to dawn. Fantine had had a night of fever and insomnia, full of happy images, though. In the morning she fell asleep. Sister Simplice, who had watched over her, took advantage of her sleep to go and prepare a fresh solution of quinine. The worthy sister had been in the dispensary only a few minutes, hunched closely over her drugs and her vials, so as to see them in the mist that dawn spreads over things. Suddenly she turned her head and let out a low cry. Monsieur Madeleine stood before her. He had come in without a sound.
"It's you, Monsieur le Maire," she cried.
He replied in a low voice, "How is the poor woman doing?"
"Not bad just now, but we were very anxious, I can tell you."
She explained what had happened, how Fantine had been very bad indeed the day before, and how now she was doing better because she believed Monsieur le Maire had been to get her little girl from Montfermeil. The sister did not dare question Monsieur le Maire, but she could see very well from his look that that was not where he had been. "That's all good," he said. "You were right not to disabuse her."
"Yes," the sister replied, "but now, Monsieur le Maire, when she sees you and she does not see her child, what will we tell her?"
He remained pensive for a moment. "God will inspire us," he said.
"But we can't lie to her.
murmured the sister under her breath. Bright sunshine streamed into the room. It struck Monsieur Madeleine's face head-on. Luck would have it that the sister looked up right then.
"My God, monsieur," she cried, "what's happened to you? Your hair is all white."
"White," he exclaimed. Sister Simplice did not have a mirror. She rummaged through a chest and pulled out a little mirror the infirmary doctor used to check if a patient was dead, no longer breathing. Monsieur Madeleine took the mirror, studied his hair, and said, "Look at that." He tossed those words off casually, as though his mind was on something else. The sister felt chilled by something unfamiliar that she detected in all this. He asked, "Can I see her?"
"Isn't Monsieur Le Maire going to go and get her child back for her?"
said the sister, scarcely daring to risk a question. "Of course. But it will take at least 2 or 3 days."
"If she does not see Monsieur Le Maire before then," she went on timidly, "she won't know Monsieur Le Maire is back. It will be easy to make her be patient, and when the child arrives, she will naturally think Monsieur Le Maire has arrived with the child. We won't have to tell any lies."
Monsieur Madeleine appeared to be turning this over for a few moments, but then he said with his customary calm gravity, "No, sister, I must see her. I may not have much time, perhaps." The nun didn't seem to notice that word, perhaps, which lent an obscure and odd meaning to Monsieur Le Maire's words. She replied, lowering her eyes and her voice respectfully,
"In that case, she is resting. But Monsieur Le Maire may go in."
He commented on a door that wouldn't shut properly, and the noise it made, which was enough to wake the patient up. Then he went into Fantine's room, went over to the bed, and pulled back the curtains a fraction. She was sleeping. Her breath was coming out of her chest with that tragic wheezing sound characteristic of such diseases, which breaks the hearts of poor mothers staying up all night watching over their doomed and sleeping children. But this labored breathing scarcely ruffled the ineffable serenity that was spread over her face, transfiguring her in her sleep. Her pallor had turned to whiteness. Her cheeks were rosy. Her long blonde eyelashes, the sole remnant of beauty that had stayed with her from the days of her virginity and her youth, fluttered while remaining closed. Her whole body trembled as if from some indescribable deployment of wings ready to fan out and carry her away, which you could feel quivering, but which you could not see. To see her like this, you would never have thought that she was so sick they despaired of her. She looked more like she was about to fly away than about to die. When a hand approaches the stem to pluck a flower, the stem shivers and seems both to shrink back and to offer itself at once. The human body undergoes something of this quivering as the moment arrives when the mysterious fingers of death are about to gather the soul. Monsieur Madeleine stayed motionless for a while close to the bed, letting his eyes wander over the patient and the crucifix, looking from one to the other in turn, as he had done 2 months earlier when he came to see her in this refuge for the very first time. They were both still there in the same position, she sleeping, he praying. Only now, 2 months later, her hair was gray, and his hair was white. The sister had not come in with him. He stayed standing close by the bed, a finger over his mouth as though there were someone in the room who had to be hushed. She opened her eyes, saw him, and said with a peaceful smile,
"And Cosette?"
Fantine, happy. She did not jump with surprise or with joy. She was joy itself. That simple question, "And Cosette?" was made with a faith so profound, with so much certainty, with such a total lack of anxiety and doubt, that he could find no words. She continued,
"I knew you were there. I was sleeping, but I could see you. I've been able to see you for a long time. I followed you with my eyes all night. You were in a cloud of glory, and you had all kinds of heavenly figures all around you."
He raised his eyes to the crucifix.
"But tell me," she went on. "Where is Cosette? Why haven't you put her in my bed, so that I'd see her the moment I opened my eyes?" He trotted out something he could no longer recall later. Luckily, the doctor, who had been alerted, stepped in and came to Monsieur Madeleine's rescue.
"My child," said the doctor, "calm down. Your little girl is here."
Fantine's eyes lit up and covered her face in brightness. She brought her hands together with an expression that held all the violence and all the gentleness that prayer can hold. "Oh," she cried, "carry her in." Touching maternal illusion. In Fantine's eyes, Cosette was still a baby that you carry.
"Not yet," the doctor went on. "Not just now. You still have a bit of fever. The sight of your child will agitate you and set you back. You have to get better first."
She cut him off anxiously. "But I am better. I tell you, I'm better. Is he all there, this doctor? I want to see my child right now. Now."
"You see," said the doctor, "how carried away you get. As long as you're like this, I won't let you have your daughter. It's not enough just to see her. You've got to live for her. When you behave yourself, I'll bring her in to you myself."
The poor thing hung her head. "Monsieur le docteur, I beg your pardon, I really do beg your pardon. Once I would never have spoken like I just did. So many bad things have happened to me that I don't know what I'm saying anymore at times. I understand you're worried about the emotion. I'll wait as long as you like, but I swear to you that it would not have set me back to see my daughter. I have seen her. I haven't taken my eyes off her since last night. Do you know, if you brought her in to me now, I'd simply speak to her very softly, that's all. Isn't it perfectly natural for me to want to see my little girl after they went and got her for me in Montfermeil? I'm not angry. I know very well that I'm going to be happy. All night I saw white things and people smiling at me. When Monsieur le Docteur wants to, he'll bring me my Cosette. I don't have a fever any more because I'm better. I can feel that there's nothing wrong with me any more at all. But I'll act like I'm still sick, and I won't budge to please the ladies here. When they see I'm perfectly calm, they'll say, 'We must give her her little girl.'" Monsieur Madeleine had sat down on a chair beside the bed. She turned to him. She was visibly making an effort to appear calm and well-behaved, as she said. "In this stage of the disease that resembles infancy, the patient is so weak, so that, seeing her so peaceful, they would not make a fuss about bringing her Cosette. Yet, though restraining herself, she could not prevent herself from firing a whole host of questions at Monsieur Madeleine. 'Did you have a good trip, Monsieur le Maire? Oh, how good you are to have gone and got her for me. Just tell me how she is. Did she cope well with the travel? Alas, she won't recognize me. After all this time, she will have forgotten me, poor little mite. Kids, they have no memory. They're like birds. Today it sees something, and tomorrow something else, and it doesn't think about anything anymore. Only, did she have clean clothes? Did those Thénardiers look after her properly? How did they feed her? Oh, how I've suffered, if you only knew, asking myself all those questions in the days when I was so poor. Now it's over. I'm so happy. Oh, how I long to see her. Monsieur le Maire, do you think she's pretty? She's beautiful, isn't she, my daughter? You must have been cold as anything in that coach. Couldn't they bring her in just for a second? They can take her away again straight after that. Tell me, you're the mayor, you can do it." He took her hand.
"Cosette is beautiful," he said. "Cosette is doing well. You'll see her soon. Just be quiet now. You're talking too fast, and you've taken your arms out from under the covers, and it's making you cough." Indeed, coughing fits were interrupting Fantine at very nearly every word. Fantine didn't even murmur. She feared that she had overstepped the mark with her few over-impassioned pleas and compromised the confidence she hoped to inspire. And she suddenly changed tack.
"It's quite pretty, Montfermeil, isn't it? In summer, people go there for picnics. What about the Thénardiers? Is their business going well? They don't get a lot of people passing through in those parts. That inn is just a flea pit."
Monsieur Madeleine held her hand and watched her with anxiety. It was clear he had come to tell her things he was now hesitant to say. Having paid his visit, the doctor had now withdrawn. Only Sister Simplice remained with him. But in the middle of the silence, Fantine yelled,
I can hear her. My God, I can hear her. She shot her arm up to demand silence around her, held her breath, and strained to listen, rapt. There used to be a little girl who played in the courtyard, the child of the concierge or of one of the women from the workshop. It was one of those coincidences that are always cropping up and that seem to be part of the mysterious staging of funereal events, that this little girl was, right then, running up and down outside to keep herself warm and laughing and singing out loud as she did so. Alas, there is nothing the games of children do not get caught up in. It was this little girl that Fantine could hear singing.
"Oh," she squealed, "it's my Cosette. I recognize her voice."
The little girl vanished as she had come. The voice died. Fantine strained to hear a little longer, then her face clouded, and Monsieur Madeleine heard her mutter,
"Fancy that lousy doctor not letting me see my daughter. He's got a mean face, that man."
But the laughing thought at the back of her mind pushed to the fore once more. She went on talking to herself, her head on the pillow.
"How happy we will be. We'll have a small garden to start with. Monsieur Madeleine promised me one. My daughter will play in the garden. She must know her letters by now. I'll teach her how to spell. She'll chase butterflies in the grass. I'll watch her. And then she'll make her first communion. As for that, when will she make her first communion?"
She began to count on her fingers.
1, 2, 3, 4. She's 7. In 5 years, she'll have a white veil, the latest stockings. She'll look like a proper little lady. Oh, my good sister, you don't know what an idiot I am. Here's me thinking about my daughter's first communion.
And she began to laugh. He let go of Fantine's hand. He listened to her words the way you listen to the wind blowing. Eyes on the ground, mind plunged into unfathomable thoughts. Suddenly she stopped talking, and her head shot up from the pillow. Fantine had become frightening. She no longer spoke. She no longer breathed. She half sat up in bed, one thin shoulder poking out of her nightgown. Her face, radiant only a moment before, was livid, and she seemed to be staring at something horrifying in front of her, at the back of the room, her eyes grown huge with terror. "My God!" he cried. "What's the matter, Fantine?" She did not reply. She did not take her eyes off whatever the object was that she seemed to see. She touched his arm with one hand and, with the other, signaled to him to look behind him. He turned round and saw Javert. Javert, satisfied. This is what had happened. 12:30 was ringing out when Monsieur Madeleine left the circuit courtroom in Arras. He had gone back to his inn just in time to leave again by the mail coach in which, you'll remember, he had booked a seat. A bit before 6 o'clock in the morning, he arrived in Montreuil-sur-Mer, and his first concern had been to mail his letter to Monsieur Lafitte, then to get to the infirmary and see Fantine. But scarcely had he left the courtroom of the circuit court than the public counsel for the prosecution, having recovered from the initial shock, had taken the floor to deplore the crazy action of the honorable mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer, and to declare that his convictions were in no way altered by this bizarre incident, which would be illuminated forthwith, and that he, meanwhile, called for the condemnation of this Champmathieu, obviously the real Jean Valjean. The persistence of the prosecutor clearly went against the feeling of all, public, judges, and jury. The defense counsel had little trouble refuting his harangue and establishing that, following the revelations of Monsieur Madeleine, that is, of the real Jean Valjean, the whole case had been turned on its head and that the jury no longer had anyone under their noses but an innocent man. The counsel for the defense had drawn from this a few epiphonemas, unfortunately not new, on judicial errors, etc., etc. The presiding judge, in his summing up, had joined the defense counsel and the jury, and in a few minutes had put Champmathieu out of the running, fully acquitting him. But the counsel for the prosecution needed a Jean Valjean, and, not having Champmathieu any more, latched onto Madeleine. Immediately after the release of Champmathieu, the counsel for the prosecution shut himself up with the judge. They conferred on the necessity of seizing the person of Monsieur le Maire of Montreuil-sur-Mer. This phrase, in which there are a lot of ofs, is from Monsieur the Counsel for the Prosecution, entirely written in his hand in the minutes of his report to the public prosecutor. The first wave of emotion having subsided, the presiding judge made little objection. Justice must indeed take its course. And then, to tell the truth, although the judge was a good man and smart enough, he was at the same time a committed and almost ardent royalist, and he had been shocked that the mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer, in speaking of the landing in Cannes, had used the word emperor and not Bonaparte. The order for the arrest was thus promptly dealt with. The counsel for the prosecution sent word to Montreuil-sur-Mer via a courier, who was not to spare the horses, tasking Inspector Javert with the job. We know that Javert had immediately returned to Montreuil-sur-Mer after having given his testimony. Javert got to his feet the moment the courier handed him the order for the arrest and the summons. The courier was himself a policeman and very much in the know, and he quickly brought Javert up to speed with what had happened in Arras. The order for the arrest, signed by the counsel for the prosecution, was couched in these terms. Inspector Javert will apprehend Sieur Madeleine, mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer, who in the hearing of this day was recognized as being the convict Jean Valjean. Anyone who did not know Javert, and who had seen him as he marched into the antechamber of the infirmary, would not have had an inkling of what was afoot, and would have thought he looked perfectly normal. He was cold, calm, grave, wore his gray hair plastered down flat against his temples, and had just mounted the stairs at his usual slow pace. Anyone who knew him well and had studied him closely would have quivered in their boots. The buckle of his leather collar, instead of lying flat on his neck, was curled up over his left ear. This revealed an agitation never before seen. Javert was the genuine article. He never allowed a wrinkle to ruffle his duty or his uniform. Methodical with crooks, rigid with the buttons of his coat. For him to have done his collar buckle up incorrectly, he had to have been experiencing one of those emotions we might call internal earthquakes. He had simply come, had grabbed a corporal and four soldiers from the neighboring police station, had left the soldiers in the courtyard, and had himself directed to Fantine's room by the concierge, who did not smell a rat, accustomed as she was to seeing armed men asking for Monsieur le Maire. Once he reached Fantine's room, Javert turned the key, pushed the door as gently as any male nurse or spook, and walked in. To tell the truth, he did not walk in. He stood in the half-open doorway, his hat on his head, his left hand over his redingote, which was buttoned up to his chin. In the crook of his elbow, you could see the lead knob of his enormous walking stick, which disappeared behind him. He stood there for a minute without anyone's being aware of his presence. Suddenly Fantine looked up, saw him, and made Monsieur Madeleine look round. The instant Madeleine's eyes met Javert's, Javert, without moving, without stirring, without coming a step closer, became truly terrible. No human feeling ever manages to be quite as appalling as gloating joy. His was the face of a demon who has come to collect his doomed victim. The certainty of at last holding Jean Valjean in his hands, captive, sent all that he had in his soul rushing over his physiognomy. The murky bottom had been stirred up and rose to the surface. The humiliation of having lost the scent somewhat and of having been mistaken momentarily about this Champmathieu was wiped out by the pride of having been so right to start with and having so long had the right instinct. Javert's satisfaction exploded in his superior attitude. A contorting triumph rippled and bloomed across that narrow forehead. There, revealed, was the full panoply of ghastliness that only the smuggest of faces can offer. Javert was at that moment in seventh heaven. Without being fully aware of it, yet with a confused intuition of his own indispensable status and of his success, he personified, he, Javert, justice, enlightenment, and truth in their heavenly function of crushing evil. He had behind him and around him, at infinite depth, authority, reason, precedent, the conscience of the law, the vengeance of the law, all the stars in the firmament. He protected order. He called forth the thunder of the law. He avenged society. He came to the aid of the absolute. He stood erect in a blaze of glory. There was in his victory a trace of defiance and of combat. Standing tall, arrogant, resplendent, he displayed, out in the open, for all the world to see, the superhuman bestiality of a bloodthirsty archangel. The fearful shadow of the act he was performing made visible in his clenched fist with the dull flashing of the social sword. Happy and outraged, he held crime, vice, revolt, perdition, hell, pinned beneath his heel. He shone, he exterminated, he smiled. And there was an incontestable grandeur in this monstrous Saint Michael. Javert, though horrifying, had nothing of the ignoble about him. Probity, sincerity, candor, conviction, a sense of duty, are things that, when they go wrong, can become hideous, but that, even hideous, remain grand. Their majesty, peculiar to the human conscience, persists even in horror. They are virtues that have a vice, error. The pitiless but honest joy of a fanatic, in the middle of perpetrating an atrocity, still preserves some mysterious radiance that is both funereal and noble. Without realizing it, Javert, in his formidable happiness, was to be pitied like any other ignoramus who triumphs. Nothing was as poignant and terrible as this face, in which what we might call all the bad of good was exposed. Authority takes back its rights. Fantine had not seen Javert since the day the mayor had snatched her out of the man's clutches. Her sick brain could not make head or tail of it, only she did not doubt that he had come back to get her. She could not bear that ghastly face. She felt as if she were dying. She hid her face in her hands and cried out in anguish, "Monsieur Madeleine, save me!" Jean Valjean, we will call him nothing else from now on, had gotten to his feet. He told Fantine in his gentlest and calmest voice, "Stay calm. It is not for you that he has come." Then he addressed Javert. "I know what you're after." Javert answered, "Move it!" There was in the tone that accompanied those two words something wild and frenzied. Javert did not say, "Move it," he said, "Move it!" No spelling could render the tone in which this was uttered. It was no longer human speech. It was an animal roar. He did not do what he usually did. He did not go into details. He did not show a summons. For him, Jean Valjean was a sort of mysterious and elusive combatant, a slippery fighter with whom he had been wrestling for 5 years without being able to pin him down. This arrest was not a starting point, but an end point. The only thing he could say was, "Move it." In speaking, he did not make a move. He shot Jean Valjean a look that he threw like a grappling iron, the kind he was used to tugging violently to pull poor miscreants into him. It was this look that Fantine had felt penetrate her to the very marrow of her bones 2 months before. At Javert's yowl, Fantine had opened her eyes again. But Monsieur Le Maire was there. What was there for her to fear? Javert advanced to the middle of the room and shrieked, "You! Are you coming?" The poor woman gazed all around her. There was no one in there but the nun and Monsieur Le Maire. To whom could this errant familiarity be addressed? Only to her, she shuddered. Then she saw something the like of which she had never seen even in the darkest days of her fever. She saw that slimy spook, Javert, grab Monsieur Le Maire by the collar. She saw Monsieur Le Maire bow his head. It seemed to her as though the world was falling apart. Javert had, in fact, seized Jean Valjean by the collar. "Monsieur Le Maire!" cried Fantine. Javert burst out laughing with that frightening laugh that showed all his gums. "There's no Monsieur Le Maire here anymore." Jean Valjean did not try to dislodge the hand that held the collar of his coat. He said, "Javert," Javert broke in, "Monsieur l'Inspecteur, to you." "Monsieur," Jean Valjean continued, "I'd like a word with you in private."
"Speak up. Speak so we can hear you," replied Javert. "People speak up when they're talking to me."
Jean Valjean continued, keeping his voice down.
I have a favor to ask you.
Speak up, I tell you!
But it's something only you should hear.
I couldn't care less. I won't listen.
Jean Valjean turned to face the man and said quickly, in a voice no louder than a whisper,
Give me 3 days. 3 days to go and get this poor woman's child. I'll pay whatever I have to. You can come with me if you want to.
You're joking, cried Javert. Well, I didn't think you were stupid. You're asking me for 3 days so you can take off, and you reckon it's to go and get this tart's brat. That's a good one. Talk about rich.
Fantine began to shake.
My child, she yelled. Go and get my child. So she's not here. Sister, answer me. Where is Cosette? I want my little girl. Monsieur Madeleine. Monsieur le maire.
Javert stamped his foot.
There goes the other one now. Shut up, you slut. What a godforsaken place. Where the galley slaves are magistrates and tarts are looked after like countesses. Well, that's all going to change, and high time, too.
He glared at Fantine and added, grabbing a fistful of Jean Valjean's cravat, shirt, and collar,
I'm telling you there is no Monsieur Madeleine, and there is no Monsieur le maire. There is a thief, there is a crook, there is a convict named Jean Valjean. He's the one I've got hold of, so that's what there is.
Fantine sat bolt upright, leaning on both hands with her arms stiff. She looked at Jean Valjean, she looked at Javert, she looked at the nun. She opened her mouth to speak. A rattle came out from deep in her chest. Her teeth began to chatter. She stretched her arms in anguish, convulsively opening her hands and groping all around her like someone drowning. Then she suddenly sank back on her pillow. Her head hit the headboard and fell forward onto her chest, with her mouth gaping, her eyes open and glazed. She was dead. Jean Valjean placed his hand on the hand with which Javert held him and prized it open as easily as he would have opened the hand of a child. Then he said to Javert,
You have killed this woman.
That's enough of that! Javert shouted, furious. I'm not here to argue. You can save all that. The guards below. Get cracking right now, or I'll get out the handcuffs.
There was, in a corner of the room, an old iron bed in a pretty poor state that served the sisters as a camp bed when they were keeping watch. Jean Valjean went over to the bed and wrenched off in a flash the already extremely dilapidated iron bar at the head of the bed, a feat that was easy with muscles like his, grabbed the rod in his clenched fist and studied Javert. Javert leaped back toward the door. Jean Valjean, the iron bar in his fist, walked slowly over to Fantine's bed. When he reached it, he wheeled round and said to Javert in a voice that could hardly be heard,
I advise you not to disturb me right now.
One thing is certain, and that is that Javert was shaking. He thought of running to call the guard, but Jean Valjean could take advantage of that moment to get away. So he stayed put, grabbed his walking stick by the small end, and leaned against the door jamb without taking his eyes off Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean leaned his elbow on the bedpost at the head of the bed, his forehead in his hand, and began to contemplate Fantine, motionless and distended. He stayed there in this position, absorbed, silent, and apparently no longer thinking about a thing in this life. There was no longer anything in his face or in his attitude other than a pity beyond words. After a few moments' reverie, he leaned over Fantine and spoke to her in a low voice. What did he say to her? What could this outcast of a man say to that woman who was now dead? What were such words? No one on this earth heard them. Did the dead woman hear them? There are touching illusions that are perhaps sublime realities. What is beyond doubt is that Sister Simplice, sole witness to what was happening, has often recounted that the moment Jean Valjean whispered in Fantine's ear, she distinctly saw a heavenly smile form on those pale lips and in those dull pupils full of the wonder of the grave. Jean Valjean took Fantine's head in both his hands and arranged it on the pillow the way a mother would do for her child. He did up the ribbon at the neck of her nightgown and tucked her hair gently under her bonnet. That done, he closed her eyes. Fantine's face in that moment seemed strangely luminous. Death is entry into the light everlasting. Fantine's hand was dangling from the bed. Jean Valjean knelt before this